So today is effectively the last session of the memory program, and given that we had a series of discussion sessions over the last few weeks, there's really no summing up as such needed. I think Muhyiddin and Nathan did a fairly good job of trying to sort of round out the picture as much as it was possible. So one part of today's session is really a formality where I, on behalf of the coordinators and all of you, would like to place our gratefulness on record to KITP for hosting us. Also the help of all the staff members, program manager David and all the rest.
Who is David? Is David here?
David is not here. So I asked him to come, but when he comes, you know, all of you know him. But
no, I don't.
Sort of individually go by his office and thank. So that's one part of it. And among the participants, there are a couple of individuals who deserve our special thanks, which are the social coordinators. Karen Daman, who left this morning, I guess she's coming back, but she's not here. And Muhyiddin Mungan, they made the social time of this program very enjoyable. Thank you. So that's sort of the, and of course, thanks to all the participants who came and took part in the very interesting discussions. Now, in terms of the science, one more formality is, of course, you all know that you have to write your exit reports and try to be as concrete as possible in terms of your takeaway lessons and anything concrete that was achieved as such as papers written or collaborations that you initiated here. Unlike many other programs where the meaning of the theme of the program is sort of crystal clear from day one, this program has been one where part of the exercise was actually to sort of ask what are the interesting questions, right? Broadly, under this umbrella of memory formation and matter, we've been sort of asking, so what does that mean and when is it interesting, okay? And so something that's sort of come up is the absence of a clear taxonomy, if you will, of what are the different interesting situations where one can productively look at these memory effects. There have been sort of all different types of examples, you know, theoretical models, simulations, experiments, etc. But they don't always correspond to each other. So one thing that some of us felt was that it would be useful to try to put our heads together and try to think of a few sort of key models, or which are simple enough that we can really ask a lot of detailed questions. And try to sort of ask the same questions of all these different cases, and see what understanding can emerge from that. All these people in the front row and I have been sort of discussing this as a sort of a take forward from this program in the coming months. Anybody who's also interested in being part of it, please let us know, let me know. And I think after after the sort of the official part of the sum up is over, we'll continue. So, please stay back if you find this is an interesting thing to be part of in the coming months, and we can talk about the details. So, David, I'm just sort of doing a general sum up, and in your absence, I did this once, but let me do it again. I would like to thank you and all the KITP staff for your wonderful hospitality and hosting this program. And I repeated sort of what each participant is supposed to do, but I guess, which is basically the exit report. And we are discussing sort of plans of how some of us might want to continue the interactions to take the work forward. So there was one question that I wanted to sort of ask you as a matter of general practice in KITP, which let me ask now. Some of the people were asking about follow-up meetings. So are such things considered by KITP? What under what conditions can you tell us?
Yeah, the follow. They have a program right now called the follow-on program, and it's generally a small group of people who you're collaborating with here. I think it's between 4 and 8 folks.
Uh-huh.
There's an application for it on the website, but I can make sure to send to you if it hasn't been sent already.
That's right.
And you propose a follow-on based on your work here.
Okay.
Typically, people are housed at it's called West Campus. Not West Campus, it's called
West Cottages.
West Cottages. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
And West Cottages are right at, you know where Coal Oil Point is? It's a beautiful location,
mm-hmm.
Right on Coal Oil Point. And then coming here to continue the work that they've begun and the collaborations they've begun when they were here. So all you do is just apply for those, and then, if it fits into the schedule and thematically, then we try to make it happen. Propose the people you're going to do the follow-up.
How many people are typically involved?
4 to 8.
Yeah, 4 to 8 typically.
4 to 8.
Yeah, 4 to 8. So it's not a huge group of people.
Yeah.
What's the success rate on people requesting those?
You know, I actually don't know that. I'll have to ask Maggie. She knows. She runs that program. I don't.
Okay.
And I'll let you know. I think it's pretty high. I think I don't know if the supply outstrips the demand, but I think we're up,
And typically, how many months after the original program do people sort of do this?
Oh, 6 months is a typical one. We've got, this is about the right amount of time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right, great. So are there other things you would like to tell us, generally?
I know, thanks for being terrific guests of KITP, especially, one of the innovation of the bartender is going to be one that is remembered for quite a long time. Here.
Oh yeah, we are being observed with these emails, right?
I see them all.
Yeah.
So I heard of both about the introduction of the bartender and the passing of the torch to a new bartender.
Yeah.
So
we think that's going to be the bar. So that's.
I think it's been, you guys have been really, I always kind of check up and see what people are doing, because part of the experience is social as much as it is. Scientific, and no one has institutionalized the bartender
yet.
This is a true innovation. And so we're going to suggest it, I think, to people down the road as a very nice. Because folks have suggested, they've been to similar types of events at like Mox Planck,
mm-hmm.
and there's like a beer vending machine, and that becomes sort of a site where social, people socialize around it. And this performs the same function as the beer vending machine, but we're allowed to have it.
It's, yeah. No, but you know, we had events both in the bar as well as the community kitchen. The thing is that in the community, once you sit around there, there's too much open space. There's lots of sound reflecting. It's very hard to conduct simultaneous conversations.
Right.
The bar area seemed to be better, and then I think we all were very happy around. The bar thing would always just last longer than, but probably partly because there was drink involved in it and so.
Right.
But I think. I don't know, my favorite kind of things were really hanging out around the bar and they're just sort of talking and chatting.
So in our program, there were also a fairly large number of musically talented people. I think that really added to these.
Music has been the program that arrived just before yours did a full recital where they... The accompanying program did an evening of music and a concert and all this. That's another thing that people have been up to. Some of the I'll send you the links if you're interested in seeing the performances. Because they taped them and put them on YouTube.
All right. So that's the next thing to aim for. All right. Now maybe the next thing is just if anybody has any scientific matters they would like to bring up, other than, like I said, I think once we go through these sort of more formal things, we will sit down and continue with the discussion that we have started earlier today. Everybody is welcome to join. But are there other things that we may not have thought of?
Yeah. No, we should thank Sri and his team for this wonderful event.
That was done already. That was done already last week. So Friday, all those things got taken care of.
Okay.
Like I said, I think especially the last three sessions last week, between Muhittin and Nathan, we had a very good sort of summary of the program. So I don't think today we're particularly going over that. But I think we should probably, if there's no other matter on the agenda, I propose that we close the formal part of the meeting. And then maybe we can go back to connecting Tom's laptop. Yeah?
Okay.
And then for those who want to stay back, who haven't seen, somebody should sort of give a quick introduction.
Okay, push the red button.
I will see. Yeah.
Red button.
Thank you
for being a terrific coordinator. And
so I'll come back to you with things that. I need to follow.
So, okay, do you remember?
I'm not here the next 2 days.
Okay. I haven't seen you since that long time ago. I like seeing you were here, but I thought you were gone.
No, I just came this week.
You just came this week. I see. So how are things? So I'm here this week. So maybe I saw you in the same room with Dan Frankel. Right. Who are you with? With you? Okay, I got it.
Yes, from this week, yes.
Yeah. So I'll come and see.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
You seen Phil yet?
Yeah.
I haven't yet seen Phil.
Okay, would you like to see him?
Yes.
I'm going to pull down the screen.
I will see you next week.
A subset of us have gotten on a jag, have gotten on the, gotten kind of focus on this notion of this subset of kind of memory that we have looked at, where you change the system adiabatically and you change it without any fluctuations, so athermally, and you ask yourself if interesting final state can emerge. And so that's, it is acknowledged as a subset of all the memory formation that we talked about. But just to try to frame this particular class of models, Muhyiddin, we had a kind of brainstorming session about it yesterday, and then Muhyiddin wrote up this write-up, which is kind of helpful in framing it. And then at 9, we all got together and talked about it, and people make comments, and so the comments are in color here. And we didn't get done. We went back and forth, and then we didn't get done, so we said we would continue after the formal wrap-up meeting that was just finished. So now we're continuing. So what do we talk about next? Where were we in the process? Well, we kind of decided, I think we kind of decided on the kind of paradigm models that we're supposed to be, this paradigm physical things that we're supposed to be trying to explain. One of these, just that even as well, I'll tell about the purple. One of these is the case of shared suspensions like the NYU group and Golub did. And that's been talked about a lot. It comes to a simple form of memory called an absorbing state. After you get there, nothing happens. And then a more complicated case is the case where you shear back and forth a suspension, something like a glass or something like a magnet that has these properties, has the property that it makes little irreversible changes. And this can make either a fixed state, but it is more interestingly, it makes a sequence of states that is remembered. The whole sequence is fixed as long as you perturb it in the same way you started. So with all these, so we're trying to explain what can happen, what should you expect to happen as far as the three things. How do the encoded states differ from generic states? You know, how special do these states get? What behavior arises from them? In other words, how do they show that they're special? And then what training process makes them happen? And what is the training process? How does the system evolve from the untrained state to the final remembered state? And the proposal is to do this by these graph models, transition graphs, where you just speak of each configuration as node on a graph, and you specify what nodes will go to what others. That's, if you let that be completely general, it's a big, big class of things. And it seems like you could choose characteristics of these graphs that would reproduce the experimental situations, both the simple ones with an absorbing state and the fancy ones that have whole sequences of behavior that have been encoded. Now, so just so I don't seem to be talking in a crazy way that nobody understands, I would ask you if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I understand what you're talking about.
He was
talking about this in his summary as well.
Yeah. This is true.
This is where this was coming from.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, we're getting there from it. Okay, so there was a whole bunch of things, points made in blue, which maybe somebody else should bring us up to the present moment of where we want to go, such as you, Sri. Are we finished? No, you wanted to go on.
No, yeah, I think, well, one thing is, you know, for the people who were in this discussion earlier, are there things that you see missing here? I mean, there are things sort of missing by design, but the overall, you know, basically the spirit of what is being summarized here is to at least sort of select a significant subset of systems where we have their interest in understanding memory formation, and but to sort of then look for good models to work with, right? I think
that's these things, right?
Right.
So
all these are possibilities. We are sort of discussing what then we should narrow down on, right? So now I guess, I mean, broadly right now we don't have sort of aging related memory effects in this list. We also don't have design-related memory formation, though that could come in some way. But really, sort of, yeah, these are sort of, as Lev was saying, attempts to come up with some automaton models where under recursive application of some rule, we sort of reach absorbing or, you know, fixed point or periodic states, which we can characterize. I think that's sort of what we're trying to focus on right now.
Lev is still here.
And Lev did sort of raise this issue of whether there are possibly more interesting transitions to some that arise in these models when in some regime, such as the yielding transition glasses or
We have a code word for that.
Elephant.
Yeah.
It's called
elephant. No, elephant is criticality. Either criticality is intimately related to memory,
yeah,
or memory can be separated from criticality and
right,
yield and studied separately.
So this is in other words, again taking sort of shared glasses as an example, the memory effects that we've been looking at are in the sub-yield regime, where the system does go into some sort of fixed point state, but then at larger amplitudes of shear, it does undergo a yielding transition. And of course, in the real system, both of these things happen, and both of them are very interesting. It's not obvious that they're sort of, there is a fundamental link between them, but it's a question whether you will always have that kind of a transition to some form of an ergodic state in the systems where we will be looking at memory effects, or
I still have an hour.
Or not. But what?
It's my computer's fault.
It's a Siri, it's not free.
It's not Siri. It's Ralph.
It's Ralph.
But everything my computer decides to say comes out on the projector. I'm afraid.
Why do you let your computer say things without your permission?
I gave it a general order earlier on. So then I have to countermand it for this particular case, and it comes up so rarely that I'm running out of time. I hope you will forgive me. Ralph doesn't intervene all that often.
So Ralph is the same program, but you've given a different name to, or?
You can give a name to a voice.
Okay. Good.
It's even called the font. Okay.
Okay, so.
Yes.
So, yeah, so I think at the moment we're saying let's sort of focus on the pre-yield situation where we do end up in fixed points of some kind. Try to understand how to describe these states.
Can you just quickly repeat for me why you think memory might be related to a critical, you might need a critical. I can understand why when you're subcritical, that means that you have many states that you can memorize, but is it necessary that they're nearby?
Most of the system that have been studied, they have this kind of transients leading you to these special states, which we associate with memory, but there is a range, there is a parameter value where this time diverges, and so you never reach the state, and this usually is a critical state, and yield, and all these words that come with it. So is it the kind of, it's necessary to consider systems that are rich enough that they exhibit this type of divergence?
So
is the time scale
isn't the generic thing a quenched glass?
Yeah, like the quenched glass type of systems, they do show yielding when in this at some values of parameter.
So
the question is to get rid of it or to keep it as a something very important part of this type of memory.
It's a trained glass. You don't just freeze it. I think the kind of things I have in mind, and maybe it's too narrow, is that you freeze it and then you put it through some kind of repeated torture. And it retains a memory of that torture that you can identify, characterize, and everything else. It's now quenched glass is in a tiny subset of its possible states from all quenches, but according to this thing we've been thinking, that's different.
Yeah.
You buy? You see what I mean?
I mean, so I think this is sort of one of the questions that one would like to know. I mean, it is so this has sort of come up. This is sort of, you know, the systems that I had in mind, which kind of biased my view on this, which is sort of, you know, these depending models or so. I mean, maybe not so much a transition, but what you have is, you know, if these systems have a hierarchy of states in the sense that, you know, if you increase the control parameter, then the sets of states that are accessible to you change in a way that kind of is maybe a subset relation or that, you know, if you have a, let's forget about it, if you have a hierarchy of states, then typically a mechanism that provides this hierarchy is something like a correlation length that is changing as you are approaching, you know, so you know, some length scale or some correlation length or some length scale that is changing as you're coming towards the transition. That typically means that there is a finite point maybe where this length scale diverges and then you have some form of criticality. So maybe in some sense, so in my mind, there could be a connection between the hierarchical organization of accessible states in its dependence on a control parameter that could go hand in hand with some form of correlation length or typical length scale that is growing as or changing as you're approaching the transition. And at least this is sort of, you know, this is kind of the essential ingredients in these exactly solvable depending models that I have been looking at with Matt and others. I mean, so it's not so much the transition, what happens once you're beyond it, that is relevant, but that you have something that's going towards the transition accompanied by some correlation length. Yeah. But, you know, nature has wonderful ways of bypassing kind of, you know, your conceptual, you know, so this is probably one of the mechanisms.
Okay. What do you mean by a depending model, please?
You know, it is actually, in some sense, a relatively simple, you know, sandfile model that you know, the one that I explained to you, where the maximum guy jumps and it takes a bunch of people along with it.
Right. It's it could be said to be, one way to say it would be pinning line of
interface.
Of a droplet of an interface.
Yeah, exactly.
A contact line.
Yeah.
You push the whole thing forward and it goes forward step by step. And it gets into a, you know, it's a thing with lots of simple characteristics. That's what, okay, yeah. So I understand. So interface, growing interface.
Growing interface, yeah.
The question that I have is that, I mean, why do you think that is necessary? I mean, there are some models which will show criticality, when you change some parameters, mm-hmm. but why do you think the presence of the criticality is necessary for...
No, I don't know. I think what I wanted to say is it's just sufficient. It is sufficient. The question is, it is sufficient,
is
I was saying.
It's not sufficient. It might... I mean, there are many systems at a critical point where there will have a potential length that diverges. But do you think that all of them can be sort of thought of as some kind of story?
Okay,
I think that's testable.
Yeah, so I don't know. Okay, maybe I should. The question is it sufficient? Is it necessary? It is at least it is a mechanism. You know, if you have this ingredient plus maybe a little bit more, you kind of maybe see this. But I think these are ultimately, I think these are questions one would like to see answered by looking at.
At least now there is one class of memories of models, memory models like the soft field models. Where this criticality happens as you increase the noise. And that is considered to be a problem rather than something that is necessary for that.
Yeah. Noise and hot field model?
Yes, a temperature, I mean. You know.
Okay. So I think this is, yeah, we talked about this some on Thursday, and I think this is something that should not be left out of our plan. And you know, Lev brought it up today quite a bit, and I think that this is something that maybe it should not be an immediate goal, but I think long term this is absolutely a crucial question that we have to
If memory really intimately linked to hierarchical structure, if memory requires hierarchical structure, then there is a link to criticality and it cannot be separated. If we can consider simpler memory without hierarchical structure, then those are in the category of memory of another type, like Price-Eck model, it doesn't have it. So there's probably sophisticated memory and simple memory. As I said, the simplest memory is a ground state, yes, or equilibrium, or elasticity, if you want, because it perfectly remembers state when you unload it goes exactly to the same state. But this is super primitive memory, yes? Then comes memory maybe without hierarchical structure, like some limit cycle somewhere. And then memories of in these complex systems where I don't know how to characterize them yet in what sense, but there is a feeling that there is a hierarchical structure behind. So when you increase amplitude, you kind of open up the set of reachable metastable states, but they should be hierarchically organized so that you won't mix them and you stay at a certain level. So maybe
so
inside this memory,
there
are different levels of kind of memory. Well,
the example of the spin glasses that I discussed, I don't know if you were here, but that's just a realization of what you were saying. There is a hierarchical structure of metastable states in the phase of space, mm-hmm. and they are non-trivially depending on temperature, and when you change temperature, you go and visit them in different ways, and you can go to memory in this way.
Okay.
There is one case at least where it's not linked to criticality, or not obviously linked to criticality. It's the low temperature phase which has this
Let's say hierarchical structure, it's already kind of scale-free object, so potentially it's an elephant in our sense.
Is your head a scale-free object?
No. It has a few levels of little of hierarchical structure. but then it's just like your computer memory, right?
That's exactly what it was.
And so computer memories themselves have outer structure, you know, you have many chips, and you have, within one chip, you have big branches and sub-branches, and it goes down the ways, but mostly...
Not the way we're talking about here. Yeah, so I think you have to define the kinds of memories, and the title of the program talked about materials that have memories, and that may be a stronger constraint
We identified some of these. All these systems, such as a glass that you're cycling the load of,
yeah.
And it gets you to some funny state that remembers how it has been cycled, and it remembers by a really specific signature of a pattern of glitches.
Determines how it responds to other kinds of information.
Well, minimally, it will just tell you what will happen if you send it through that same cycle again. Yeah. It certainly remembers that. It will completely the hell if you do anything different. Yeah. But at least it remembers that, and that's a really kind of rich thing that it did. And it could be that as it gets richer and richer, you have to be able to conceive of some kind of outer structure that looks like the inner structure, in other words, a hierarchy. But we don't know that. It's a good question to ask. And that's, now I understand why you're interested in the elephant, because you say, you are not going to be able to explain any of this stuff without implicitly saying there's a hierarchy, and you have to identify that.
Yeah, there are trivial memories in a sense. That's probably the program should have been called non-trivial memories or something like this. And so it's important to separate those and say that this is a focus.
In the bylaws of KTP's program, yes. They only support non-trivial
stuff.
Yeah. Really, that's not really historic, right? I can testify.
If you want other memories, book a vacation
package. Just to be clear, I think, at least for this particular discussion, the goal is not so much to be, it's good to have a comprehensive view, but I think what we want to do now is to form a working group where we'll focus on some questions and try to make progress in some desirable direction.
Why are we specializing in AQS?
That's part of the answer is what I just said.
How would you slice it?
From my point of view, that precludes your considering my head, for example, or anything. Or even materials that are realistic.
So, but temperature will erase.
We're not supposed to capture everything.
Temperature will erase memory, yes? So the idea is to stay with the big barriers.
The age of the universe.
Not necessarily, because in this example again, it's temperature.
But at least cold system, but then you radicalize it and make it zero temperature.
Even a cold system is not in the universe. Because it's not quasi-stationary.
Yes.
A cold system has internal dynamics.
It's a thermal cold.
It has its time scales.
No, but if you do a thematically drive, then all internal relaxation process will be instantaneous at this time scale.
No.
So it depends how slow you drive. Yes?
Well, that's true, but you have to drive the system anomalously slowly, especially if you have something that was glass with many wide range of
temperatures.
So
at least memory has to be stable with respect to finite temperature. It's something that is memory only at when there is no noise. That I think is not particularly interesting. So there has to be some stability towards putting in some noise, which will still keep the memory.
It's an abstract question of,
this
type of zero. And another thing is practical, to what extent it can survive little noises in the room that is it's true.
AQS really, in my opinion, is a very strong restriction on whether you're talking about physical systems or mathematical systems.
It is. Jim, that's to this little group, that's a virtue.
Yeah.
It's so restriction.
Okay, fine. I that's fine.
No, but the goal is to find, because by simplifying dynamics this way, to removing fast time scales, you can reduce it to automata and to simpler dynamical systems, and you make it a bit transparent, because if you add this fast dynamics there, so it's a usual trick that you just go to the limits and to see certain things more clearly. But I agree that in real systems this is an issue.
Yeah. But a lot of people historically, maybe some of this room, I forget, have done all kinds of AQS simulations, and said, oh, doesn't this look just like a glass or something like that?
Okay.
And the answer is almost certainly not, because you've not got the earlier glass in dynamics. And that's
right, so we're not going to explain.
I'm an old girl.
Well, it's good, yeah, it's good.
But I don't think it's the theory of everything, because I think there are systems, or certain, maybe not even systems, but systems under certain experimental conditions. And I think some of these memory experiments that have been performed fall into this category. So, you know, substates of certain systems, not even the systems themselves in all their possible behavior, but some sub-behavior that seems to be described at least, you know, and I'm qualifying even further, at least to zeroth order by some AQS dynamics. You could ask, okay, well, this is not the whole story, but we are not trying to describe with AQS the whole system under all possible conditions. But you know, under some conditions, it seems to be like a starting approximation, and then you may be, well, if there are other effects important, they may be secondary, and they can be sort of introduced as some kind of perturbation. I think we all agree that AQS is just a working kind of hypothesis that, you know, just sort of may shed light on a specific subset of a much larger class of problems.
Yeah, but I think, the two parts of it, I think we had this discussion sometime earlier during this program. The athermal part, as Chandan just now said, it is important that you at least believe that the systems you're looking at will not be radically different in their properties if you add finite temperature, yeah. Right? And I think that is not, it hasn't been demonstrated to be a serious problem. The other side of it is the quasi-static part, and clearly there, if you are interested in dynamical questions, you know, including things like what's the nature of avalanches, the dynamics will matter. Yeah. So some of the answers will depend on whether you're in the quasi-static limit or not. So one has to be careful. But the issue is, but the question we should ask right now is, are there any things that we are interested in looking at which are radically affected by the fact that we are in this limit? And I believe no, because basically what we are interested in are questions related to sort of some subset of states that the system will converge to as a result of whatever dynamics you're applying. And I think that certainly generically will happen. So unless you are careless about the questions you ask, I think it's okay.
Put me down simply and say, I think you have to be even more careful than you're saying.
Okay, but is that anything? No, but so.
So clearly if there is some effect that is destroyed by temperature or finite rate of loading, then it's not robust. So it's very important to identify.
But look, I think, you know, part of what we were talking about earlier was trying to identify experimental systems that we could tether these to, these models to. And I think that will help with keeping
this. Have you identified?
But Jim, are there sort of specific things that you worry about, or it's just that
what about this? Be careful not to overclaim relevance to broad glassy phenomena. Yeah.
That's fair enough, but that's too.
That's what he was trying to worry about. He told you he had all these people with the AQS model that it was supposed to describe glasses and the important things, it was not appropriate at all. And he says we should be careful not to fall into that trap.
I agree.
We put you down as saying that, Jim. some contribution. So this isn't, this thing that we're doing is not supposed to be summing up the major important problems that were, you know, came to a focus in the meeting. It's probably kind of in the larger scheme of things, it is not the most important at all, but it's that we see an opportunity for this particular subset that is motivating us to focus on it.
Well, look, you know, but I think I was telling Nathan after listening to Roma earlier this week, though we haven't been thinking about it, these kind of manipulation of systems can lead to pretty interesting things. So Roma was talking about basically looking at shared suspensions, but they're sort of talking about materials processing and how to reduce the viscosity of suspensions. A lot of very interesting things can come up. So it's not strictly an academic exercise. Implications we're not necessarily, but I think at the moment we're really just asking how to think about these things as concretely as possible by taking the course to some simple-minded models.
Yes.
Is the transition matrix-based models, and what is it sort of well developed in the sense that, you know, what are the characteristics of the matrix that you need to be able to do something that looks like a memory? Or...
So in this particular context, what we had done was to define some very simple-minded transition matrices with which to look at memory effects, but that didn't necessarily have structure that corresponded to some physical model. But so one possible direction to take it in is to sort of try to approach, while keeping the simplicity of the models that we look at, try to sort of build transition matrices that correspond to some physical situation. So the Prezak model is one such possibility we're thinking of as a base model, where you just imagine your system as being composed of non-interacting two-level systems, and then you can then build the corresponding transition matrix.
We should think of an example that you already know.
Yeah, which so that's the starting point. So we want to use that as an exercise where we then ask all the questions that we want to ask.
And you have some block structure, for example, that will really be partitioned into states into such that, you know, depending on where you start from, you will remain.
You're thinking of a thing that would take you from one scale to another, like a renormalization transformation. You told me in your, in your model where an advancing interface, mm-hmm. and you have to say, what's the most unstable thing, and then it grows. There's a lot of things of that form.
Yeah.
And you usually say, it can't grow. You identify specific things next to it and saying it can grow whether or not, depending on what those things next to it are doing. And so it's a map from their state and your state to your future state. It's you know all kinds of things about that. And that's what these are like, but unlike that, the thing I just said has a dimension. It has me and my two neighbors, which are at these specific positions. And a lot of these things that we're trying to develop don't have any notion of space. We just say, build this completely random transition matrix with a few qualitative properties. The ones that we are thinking of is, it's always three states going to one. That's what we've had, a particular number of states transition to a particular, let's see, there are multiple states that lead to the same outcome.
And maybe some of these, you know, the way these ideas, you know, it has emerged kind of, you started with some, you know, with some specific model which had the space dimensions, but then if you were asking, you know, what happens to the response of this model when I'm kind of forcing it, it turned out you could answer these kind of questions if you just, if someone told you, oh, you know, if this state becomes unstable, it goes into this one, you know, if it goes unstable into the other, it goes this one. These are the numbers that, you know, these are the thresholds among which it's saved. So even, you know, so it turns out that many of these kind of space-containing models on a level of state transitions are just captured by some kind of graph where you have things like many go into one. So the question is, how much of this feature, you know, by itself explains some of the phenomena? So how much do I really need to know about the space part?
If, for example, many go into one plus no loops. Okay, those are separate. You can have either one without the other.
Yeah.
And we find neat things happen if you say both.
Yeah. So that's why we thought that it would be a good idea to pursue this idea to its limits. So then, you know, the next level of questions, well, you know, like Jim is, well, but this is AQS, but real life is not AQS. What happens to your picture once you put that into consideration? But I think this seemed like a path that could be kind of gone, you know, it was well-defined things to look at, to sort this out once and for all, either to put the nail on the coffin, you know, or to sort of see, oh, you know, there's actually something, you know.
Open the coffin.
Or to open the coffin, right. You know, it seems like an elephant that yeah.
That there's an element in the coffin.
So,
so the question is, with space or without space, will this type of anti-branching models would be sufficient to capture those effects? Do we need a space or not?
Right.
Because in many of those events, the dynamics goes like in a sense in the sand piles. You have a threshold, local thresholds. You do these complex updates, and then you evolve in this way.
Because when you say space, do you mean space or
microscopic dynamics?
No, something with a metric, something with a dimension. Yeah. You need to specify where the different points are with respect to each other. Or can you just leave that alone?
I mean, sort of, you know, the update rule. You sort of first flip this pin, and then, you know, it's basically a microscopic rule that tells you how the configuration changes. You know, by applying something to its
So I just remember I said one thing I sent a mail about considerations of energy and proximity.
Mm-hmm.
So that was in reference to this idea of needing to specify how close different states are, but you can also you don't have to sort of work in real space necessarily. Even if you just say I work with certain sets of states in some configuration space, I can still talk about how close or how different they are.
That's a question, whether one can get rid of this element of structure, which is space, connectivity, this kind of kernels that have paramagnetic, anti-paramagnetic components, all this that have resurfaced as a big part of the existing models of plasticity. Or one can compress it into those rules. But so far, the rules are invented independently of the model itself. They just guesses. So we don't have a bridge between kind of branching or anti-branching schemes and the space, the models with the space.
I see it kind of as because we see some of these already. I mean, I see this as some form of, there's a systematic way of putting these in. And this is, I think, how these discussions came about. You know, the people that were, you know, modulo GM3 max, but you know, in this visco, in this elastoplastic models, for example, whether this HAP kernel that they were using, you know, had negative entries or not, was kind of influenced the way the system is behaving. And sort of, for example, a HAP kernel with no negative entries is apparently tantamount to some form of no passing that the system has. And so, you know, it is that if you have sort of, and then this no passing restricts in some sense the structure that you can, you know, grasp that whose underlying kind of spatial structure had no passing, it will put strong restrictions on the glasses that you can, it will put strong restrictions on the state transition graphs that you can observe. You know, when I look at these graphs, I could say, oh, this, the, you know, whatever kernel gave rise to the actual transitions, its HAB must be non-negative because it has, you know, no passing, and that no passing is a strict form of return point memory. I think there are connections of, you know, structure of the kernel having some influence on what kind of graphs you should kind of be considering, you know, ensembles of graphs. And I think these are exactly the questions that, you know, that one should, you know, that in this modeling, that this should be kind of, you know, like a dough, you know, these ingredients should be folded into this as you start to understand these systems better.
Okay. So, yeah, as I said, my, you know, if we can start with a real system and come up with a model that's simple enough, I think that's a sweet spot. So why don't we now sort of try?
What is the most simple system? That's the question.
No, so let's get, but this we can do not by talking generalities. I think let's go through the list of things that we have in this file and decide. So, but let me take this opportunity also just to say, I mean, as we said, the goal by the time I'm leaving this afternoon is to think of up to a maximum of three different model systems that we're going to focus on. And for each of them, I would like to see that there is a concrete plan and a team of people who will work on it. So the idea is, I mean, I would like to see that the larger group remains a working group that is in discussion with each other, but that doesn't necessarily mean that for each particular problem, everybody will either be interested or it's meaningful for them to be part of the working, the collaborative team. But how to converge on these is something that we should talk about. Let me propose what I think would be interesting. I think for any particular model system that we talk about, there will be some natural choice of who can lead the effort. And then I think the rest of us should sort of indicate interest in being part of the collaboration if they think they can do something. And the people who are leading that particular project should then take it forward from there. Is that a reasonable working approach? Because I think
I think that's a reasonable goal. Reasonable outcome.
But I mean, because
you want to make a Manhattan project.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I want all of us to come.
So we need the general growth.
So what I'm saying is, I think if there's like order of 10 people who say we're all interested in taking this forward, we should continue some form of discussion. But then if we say we're looking at like three different model systems, I don't know if it's reasonable that all of us are, in some sense, in the collaboration. But I would sort of err on the side of including anybody who says they're interested. And people have to sort of self-select whether they, based on whether they can make their contributions. Right? So now I'm just setting the ground rules because I think we need to start somewhere in thinking concretely beyond this stage.
Yeah. Okay.
Would you like an example, folks?
Yeah, so here we go.
So this is a graph made by Wheaton meant to describe cyclic shearing. Cyclic shearing consists of two phases, one where you're increasing the shear, one where you're decreasing it back. Each of these is proposed as being represented as one of these maps with a, where every site has either zero precursors that would go to it, or it has three sites that would go to it. So if you see this one, there's three red arrows going into it. And there's every single site has three red arrows going into it. This represents the shearing in one direction. And these graphs also have that second property that they're tree-like, that you can't have any loops. When you have that, this individual graph, just talking about shearing in one direction, is kind of not rich. It leads to a fixed point. That's the fixed point for the reds right there. Everything goes to here no matter where you start from, either in a few steps or in many steps. But that's not the whole story in shearing. You are also shearing in the opposite direction. And so one could ask what would happen if one sheared downward for several steps and then started shearing upward. And then the thing gets more interesting. And the question is, if you only shear upward, the graph for upward was just like the graph for downward. And so it leads to a fixed point here. But we have blue arrows to tell the upward. I don't think they're so distinguishable here, but there's three blue arrows coming in. And each side has three blue ones and three red ones, but I cannot see the red ones for site 77.
No, each side has one red going out and one blue going out.
And then oh, it has this 77 happened to have no blues coming in.
Red.
But 29 is my favorite. It has three reds coming in and it has three blues coming in.
This is
can't
see random
them. What did you say? These were picked.
This assignment that who goes into whom, that is done at random? Or?
Completely at random. The most random we could think of. And so now, suppose you do the following kind of annealing. The real annealing is you do red, 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 and blue, 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 blue. We think of it, one step of this cycle, as enough to take you to the next irreversible event, the next glitch, which we saw there's many of these irreversible events during any of these annealing cycles. So we know that according to Sri's computers, there are often 20 of these little irreversible glitches to get up through one sweep of half cycle. So we should realistically make multiple red ones followed by multiple blue ones and multiple red ones. Now that one red one, it'll only take you to here and it won't do anything interesting. But if you take multiple red ones and then multiple blue ones, or even let's say one red, one blue, one red, one blue, one red, then it can do all kinds of interesting things. Mm-hmm. One thing that it does is it comes to a final state and it just stays the same at that state. This final state in a graph is it's distilled from a small fraction of the original states. We started with 90.
It's not a final, it's a final subgraph.
It's a final subgraph. It's not a final single fixed point.
Yeah.
But it doesn't change after that.
Right.
And so the final subgraph, although the generic nodes have many coming into them, the final subgraph only has one coming into it. And so it can be reversed. It's a permutation. And it's almost as rich as a generic permutation, which if you look at what a random permutation can have, it can have a number of cycles that go around and around. This can have that. I mean, we tried this. Will these graphs do that have all this rich structure of a generic perturbation? And it does, it has fixed points and a whole range of cycles of different sizes. So we want to explore this. We want to make a great big one. And Muhyiddin has just made a partial explanation, exploration so far of 90,000 nodes instead of 90 nodes. Isn't that right?
Yeah. 9,000.
9,000, okay.
But anyways, I mean, it's, we wanted to see, you know, we looked at these small systems and it looks like, you know, although you start with 90 nodes, almost everything focuses into some invariant set that just has a handful, you know, there's three cycles that it goes to and so on. And so this is kind of the simplest kind of null model that you can think of. So the question is, what, how much of this can we understand? How much of this is in any way is relevant to kind of what people observe in their experiments? And so I think we were surprised that even with something like this, you have quite some strong kind of focusing into some subsets. And we want to kind of just get a little bit more an idea how much this depends on the details. So this was, we just said that every node, yes, all the
details. So you generated the graph randomly.
Yeah, and this is not, yeah.
So then probably you can probably compute which are the number of unit cycles and so on with the statistical.
This is sort of the, I mean, once we decided it is interesting and worth understanding, then comes the random graph. And I think mathematically it's interesting because this is really two graphs on the same set of nodes. So it is a little bit of a, and I haven't seen people discussing these kind of graph structures, but they are natural structures in the context of these AQS models, because from each node you have two types of transitions, one under increasing of the force and one under decreasing of the force, and they don't have to be inverses of each other. Or this whole cycle business comes from the fact that one transition is not undone by the other one. And so it's a sort of this double graph structure. And then the graph has to be, in some sense, acyclic, because as if I increase the force and increase the force, I cannot be in a cycle. I mean, I'm always getting into a new state that has a property that is monotonously increasing or changing. So it is really a superposition of two acyclic graphs on the same common set of vertices. And then the question is, how are you kind of gluing these graphs? This is sort of the simplest model where we just say, look, let me generate two independent trees and just glue them on top. But this is probably not correct, because there is probably correlations. The one graph tells you also some information about the other graph, because this is kind of, if you think about hierarchical organizations, then, you know, maybe within one transition, you cannot really go across very high, but there's a sense of locality that has, you know, of what you can locally access, that both of the graphs have to respect. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of the next step. So Tom and I have been thinking about this, the kind of, you know, how one can enforce this locality.
Anything just in terms of the construction of the graph.
Yeah.
Now, the self-mapping, the blue and the red circles.
Yeah.
So the, that's, I mean, that's obviously, so for each node, the rule is three arrows in, one up.
That's right, and then some, that's two kinds. There have to be, if this is to be a mapping from a set, a given set of nodes off onto that same set, there's on average one, since it's a map, every node has to have one going out, I mean exactly one, and that's going to have 90 of those outward going arrows, but each one of them has to be clustered into two others. Wherever it goes, there has to be two others there too. That's the constraint. So there have to be two-thirds of the nodes with nothing going to them, no path to them.
But the question I had is, the outgoing arrow can either be to itself or to something else. And how did you just put that in by hand?
It go to somebody else.
We wanted to say that the graph of the black arrows is a tree, because that's the simplest acyclic graph that you can think of. Okay. So which means that ultimately there must be a root of the tree, something that doesn't go anywhere else. So that one is just necessary. There's one die that connects to itself. And so since we basically have as many arrows as we have nodes.
Okay. Is there a physical meaning of this one that goes to itself?
Number one, it violates the three, because you have four in.
No, it's, don't have a look, let's look at the red. This is one, and the one that goes to Excel.
Oh, no, the 52 is also going in.
That's not red, is it?
You're right. Well, this is a, there is no yielding.
No, you're right, you're right. What is with the 52?
No, come on. No, guys, come on, come on.
Red.
Maybe.
Yeah, but the defense part is the self loop. I mean, you know, it's just.
That's what she's saying, it.
Okay, there's more. Yeah, okay, but in the end, we could have done this, we could, I mean, at this point, you know. Okay, the law is, except for one and two can have four in, okay? In fact, because of this, you have, but, you know, this is, the fact is you have two roots in there. You have a root in this tree, okay? And so this has four going in, and there's somewhere another node that will have only two going in, because in the end, that has to add up to three as well. So this has four plus two is three plus three. There's two nodes at which you're doing an exception, but the thing is that hopefully the limit that this is.
But then you could have avoided, right?
I could have avoided it, yeah, but this, you know, this was the simplest, you know. But before coming today, you should have asked me, you know, why do you allow every node to have those three arrows coming in?
Okay, that's a choice, right?
Yeah, so, okay. Yeah, and so the root in some sense is also a choice, that the root has four arrows coming in, the price of which means somewhere there is a node out there that has only two arrows coming in. But I don't think that this makes, you know, qualitatively, I think these are, you know, these are kind of, you know, this was, you know, this is start, let's start with the simplest thing we can do. That is also simplest to code and implement.
Right, so this is just a kind of an experimental exploration that we have in mind, but it has a lot of math questions behind it. So we want to see how the thing scales with size. We want to see what protocols give more cycles and what give less. And is it, if you have a bigger system, does it take longer to train it?
Mm-hmm.
You would think so.
Yeah.
And, but then there's all these kind of subtle questions that the simulations will not be able to answer. And among these is, suppose I start from a random red and blue graph. We have designed like get a permutation. Is it a random permutation or is it a biased permutation? Or we don't know that, but that's clearly very important because all kinds of stuff is known about random permutations, but we don't know if we have one. So, and then as you were hitting at, there's plenty of other questions that you could have deduced without having done the simulation, that you can understand what some of the things the simulation gives just from theorems. And we have them aspired to try to nail those down. But it's certainly a thing that should absolutely be done.
So can I just make the following suggestion? We're approaching lunchtime. So let me just sort of mention two other models which I think we could focus on. And if we all agree, let's sort of break lunch at that point and then we come back together and talk. Okay? So I think the two other models that we should think about are the second is a transition matrix model, initially Prezard, but variations to be incorporated. Okay?
Okay, Prezard, say that again.
So basically a transition matrix model,
mm-hmm.
Which will initially be derived from the Prezard model, but I think we should then go beyond that to sort of make it more realistically
it's actually spelled Prezasach. But Prozac is the Prozac model to philosophy.
Prozac.
Yeah, the Prozac. Yeah.
And I think the third model that would be nice is the model that Lev talked about. And then it has the benefit of being derived from, this is the top, you know, which, I don't know which way is which, but is it top down or bottom up? It's going the other way.
Okay. Yeah, it starts from an actual model.
It starts from physical system, Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think at the end of the day, you have a description which is.
But you're talking
that's
about.
Your
yeah, but we still have space.
Yeah?
Oh.
Yeah,
so
this is Lev's PRL 2008, right? The one that we talked in I think, no, it's, I think if you are talking about which model, you are talking about two different models. I think you have...
They all reduced to automata, but different ones.
Which one do we have in mind?
Do you want
the shared memory model that you talked about? No, the other one is...
Okay, the shape memory.
What's the shape memory model?
Because, I mean, so Lev, is that correct that at the end of the day, the dynamics of the system can be represented in the spin states? Right? And that seems to be a very attractive simplification. Then we can sort of see how to, and then you've already done.
Yeah, the main thing there is that there is a yield disorder. It's not quenched. So there is a co-evolving, there is a one process happening, which is this, say, phase transition or magnetism or kind of Ising type, but on the background there is a disorder which by itself is evolving, and how it is co-evolving, and that brings the system to interesting place.
All right, so you have a two-man process too?
Yeah.
Is it true? Cool. Okay, I have annealing process too. Whoops.
It's anneal disorder. It's a disorder that is breathing by itself.
What are the two processes?
But in the end, the configuration.
What is the first of the two processes?
The configuration
first
of the
same phase transition.
Are spins, the spins.
Or
the spins.
The local shape transformation.
As I know, that you go from one spin configuration to the other.
Oh, this sort of thermal relaxation structure.
It's not thermal, it's a thermal relaxation.
Okay.
So there are thresholds.
A randomization, though.
So can I ask a question about these categories? So these models, so these are sort of abstractions. So the transition is sort of
abstraction. One is transformation.
Is one of
these both transformation?
Shear suspension? System, or is that
dealing with double well potentials roughly, and another is the disorder which is co-evolving. So it's a kind of random fieldizing model, if you want, but the disorder by itself is naturally evolving together with spins. Usually disorder is quenched.
This is also
For this, you have limited type of behaviors, but if disorder is co-evolving as you drive the system, then this can be a more interesting place.
I don't know.
Where can you get to with just one?
Try to come up with a.
With one, you have just a normal discrete point. You have to have a special
model that has basically the same behaviors, the same rules for
transition. Here you can have
Things on the back.
There's nothing on the table right now.
I was thinking a little bit about that.
Transformation.
Why is this not transformation?
Because it enters.
But there is a way of discretizing.
Anything that
you can say primary order parameter and second order parameter.
I think there is a way of discretizing this.
And second order parameter,
you see, you have at least in 1D, you have these spell particles, right? And so consider bonds, which is the distance between two square particles.
There's no reason not to be able to do it. I can't talk about this.
Yeah, offline. But you see, each of these bonds are either colliding or non-colliding. So you project this between zeros and ones. And you know that the absorbing state is when all the bonds are 0, 0, 0. And you know, if it's colliding, then you know it has to swell from there, which means it might either make its neighbors turn from 0 into 1, or, you know, stay at 0. And eventually it might get. So maybe some, you know, this would be how I would kind of coarse grain it. But whether you can really do some reliable dynamics out of it, I don't know.
No, I think you can. It's a nonlinear diffusion model.
Of these ones, the one bonds, basically.
Discrete, yes.
Discrete bonds, you know, we have two kind of bonds, colliding and non-colliding.
I think you can absolutely get all the behaviors you want that way.
So maybe this would be as close as you would get to kind of a discrete.
But I think you'd want to do something a little bit more potsy, right? You want to have more than two states. for each.
Maybe.
Because then you could want to be able to put multiple memories in.
Yes.
No, but the.
Yeah, then you would, okay.
No, but the discrete version, so the 1D model that you have looked at already is.
It's not Potsy.
Suspension.
Potsy turvy.
But it has sort of.
Potsy turvy. This could be put on, this could be put on a lattice, so that would be your.
No, but wasn't it already done, is what I'm asking.
Potsy turvy.
Potsy turvy.
Not in the.
Let's not start it now, because then I will shut up.
You have to be in New York, but.
But that's the.
Meaning.
What do you mean? No, so that's sort of, that can be.
Okay, we have a plan, yes, okay.
Okay, so. Well, we don't yet have a plan, because Joey.
You just want to recall you. We want to recall you now for lunch, right? And we have three problems proposed.
Well, the problem.
I think you would have gone with way.
No, no,
continues. Preliminary plans of the land.
What was your question, Joey? I was busy.
Oh, whether the shared suspensions fit into, or could fit into just one of these transition matrix abstractions, or whether we need to dream up another abstract model to think about it.
Let's say, I would say even the pure red model, the thing is, it doesn't, because you only have fixed points, you only have absorbing states, but you have so many different ones possible, and it's hard to say.
But can we discretize it so that it's enumerable?
Oh.
This is
so you would put the Chaikin model on a lattice or something like that? So
yeah. If people have studied lattice gas models that are analogous to the Chaikin model,
That would be probably not the smart way of discretizing
it.
You have to do a kind of discretizing based on some form of cross training. Like, you know, maybe my suggestion is too simplified. But
I think instead of ones and zeros, we can have zero ones and twos. And
or something like that. Yeah.
Actually, with the appropriate rules,
yeah.
We could build an automaton like. Model.
Maybe, so, yeah. But I think it would not be discretizing space. That would just be it wouldn't probably get anything by making, it's
oh, I see, discretizing space and having particles move.
Yeah,
I don't know if but we've already done like Joey studied this extensively, the 1D model, and it works fine. Can we just discretize that?
But maybe you can kind of do. I think your 1D model. If you send this, I think even the way you've set up the 1D model, that is probably just can be converted into some form of, Markov process or something, where you configure. Your model might even just, you could make it fit into this framework, but if you gave it to some probabilist that knows what he's doing, this is probably kind of, you could just get mileage out of the top model just by itself. I mean, this is kind of like, this process continues in time. This is some sort of continuous space, continuous time Markov process. Your description of when they overlap, they go in epsilon, they part, and then if they part, nothing happening, is basically defines what would be called the generator.
That's right.
And of this process, and then there's probably a whole bunch of things that you can prove for this limit that the number of particles goes.
So are you saying that it's maybe so simple that you can just require an abstraction step?
Whereas
the amorphous solids. There's no hope of addressing it directly.
I think this model in 1D for sure, in 2D probably maybe, but in 1D for sure, I think there is probably a whole machinery that you can at least formulate this problem, and then whether it's solvable or not, and you have to make maybe some clever approximations. I don't know, but I can kind of based on my kind of experience with these things, and I'm not an expert, but if I'm forced to solve this problem mathematically, this is what I would do. And I can maybe even, I'm in this Institute of Applied Mathematics, that is basically people's bread and butter. I think, this could be doable. But there could be a slick way of bypassing all this machinery because it's complicated. And maybe do what, it's sort of some
you know, something state overlap, the overlaps are, you know, are spin variable, and if there's something.
I think you could find out in this would be a few hours.
Okay. Yes, you go somewhere, and that would be a lot easier.
Yeah. Because I think that, and I think that.
No, but could you, maybe when we come back, but let's do that as quickly as possible. I have a 1:45 cutoff.
Okay.
1:45 cutoff on what? Finishing business?
Yeah.
So maybe we'll just grab our lunch and just.
No, I have a lunch with somebody. I may need time from 12:30 to 1:30 at least, so.
Okay.
I'm already committed, so. But we may start.
I think that, I mean, one thing that I really want to address, and I guess Joey too, is like, what are the experimental systems that we're trying to, I mean, so far we have some very good ideas about amorphous solids, about what models, what simplified models might help there.
I think the discussion that we had, in your shared colloids, right?
Yeah.
Where you have these regions where this D2-min is basically localized, and you know, maybe where you could kind of discretize transitions.
Sure.
That would then in the end lead to some kind of state transition graph.
So I think that is, I think, I mean, yes. I think it's a really great experimental system. There are opportunities to exploit these more abstract models and opportunities to connect with different simulations. And certainly AJ Sood's system as well has that potential. Although maybe, you know, the way that he's analyzing it is maybe not as amenable to this, to what you're doing. But I think shared suspensions is another one, and if we can identify any others, because I think being able to span the entire gamut from abstract model to
data
to somewhat, you know, low fidelity simulation to high fidelity simulation to experiment, I think is if we can identify that path, we really should lock it in.
So you might have ideas.
Yeah, so
I think we have ingredients.
I agree with the spirit of what you're saying, but I think the danger of putting too many things on the table is that you can't concretely take it forward. What may be better is to sort of identify an initial set of problems that you think are optimal somehow. But then if we're also working together on these, I think we can sort of take it forward to the next stage as we go along. This is so these are two separate things. One is in refining that list that is in Moritin's file, we could probably put these things down, but let us try and identify, like I said, order of three things. That's my suggestion. Because I just feel like if it goes beyond that, it gets too many things.
So I like your plan. I mean, especially, you know, we have to think about, like,
they talk about
what would be the first two or three papers that would come from this, for instance, and they maybe should not involve the full gamut from experiment to
thing is that as far as who does it, I mean, we might be able to help you a little bit of figuring out an experiment, but really you guys are the ones who, in contact with this theory aspect, would say, geez, I could implement that, or this is just like so-and-so system.
Okay.
And then you could fly with it. I mean, then we'd be, at most, your little sidekick when you flew with it. But it's not
we can't help with it, of designing the experiment very much.
No, perhaps, but...
So should we go get lunch and come back?
Yes.
All right.